Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Family Plot, a novel by Megan Collins, read by Emily Tremaine.
1. My parents named me Dahlia, after the Black Dahlia, that actress whose body was cleaved in half, left in grass as sharp as scalpels, a permanent smile sliced onto her face. And when I first learned her story at 4 years old, I assumed a knife would one day carve me up. My namesake was part of me, my future doomed by her violent death. That meant my oldest brother, Charlie, who had escaped the Lindbergh baby's fate by living past age 2, would still be abducted someday. My sister, Tate, would follow in her own namesake's footsteps, become a movie star, and then become a body in a pool of blood. And my twin brother Andy, named for Lizzie Borden's father, I was sure his head was destined for the axe. It didn't take me long to shed that belief, to understand that our names were just one of the many ways we honored victims of murder. But even after I stopped expecting us all to be killed, Andy insisted our family was unnatural, that the way we were raised wasn't right. I still don't know where he got that idea. Back then, the life we lived in our drafty, secluded mansion was the only kind of life we knew. Now I'm standing in front of it, the home he ran away from on our 16th birthday, 2 years before we were scheduled to get our inheritance. Leaving money, as Charlie called it, and 3 before I left myself, having waited there, certain my twin would return, for as long as I could. I used to sit at the bottom of the stairs, gaze pinned to the door, hoping he'd walk through it again, tell me all my missing him was for nothing. I was the only one who missed him. Mom read his note, "The only way out is to never come back," and swallowed hard. "Your brother's chosen his own path," she said, swiping at her tears as if that was the end of it. Dad stomped around the house for a while, grumbling about the hunting trip Andy had skipped out on. "He's a coward, that twin of yours," Dad told me, as if Andy belonged to me alone. And then there was Charlie and Tate, who were visiting when we found the note. They'd come all this way for our 16th birthday, but they left without helping me look for him, Charlie claiming he had an audition, Tate trailing after him like always, which left just me, alone in my anguish for years after that, lighting the candles with Mom and Dad, saying the honoring prayer that I've since learned they created themselves. Dad died the other day. That's why I've come back. And I'm hoping this will be the thing that brings Andy back, too. Maybe he's already inside, listening for my footsteps. Maybe I can stop my internet searches. Every week, I look for my brother on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. Greta, who runs the cafe beneath my apartment, has taught me all the tricks on social media. But still, my searches come back each time with nothing. Today, I took the long way up from the ferry, watching the rocky shore recede below me as I climbed higher toward the center of Blackburn Island, where our house looms stony and colorless in front of the woods. For minutes now, I've been staring at those skeletal trees, remembering how Andy used to whack at them, how he'd pick up his axe whenever something flared inside him, and how almost anything could set him off. Dad quizzing him about hunting rifles, Mom teaching us about Ted Bundy's victims, Tate sketching her namesake, Sharon. For all the hours Andy and I spent locked to each other's hips, hiding in the credenza to jump out at Mom, distracting our groundskeeper with leaf pile forts, I never understood why he'd spring out of the house sometimes and pick up the axe that leaned against the shed. And when he told me, over and over, that our family was unnatural, that we needed the outside world, needed to trust people beyond each other, I didn't understand that either. The November wind is icy on the back of my neck, pushing me closer to the front door. Dead leaves skitter around my feet as if welcoming me home. It's been 7 years since I last stepped foot on this porch. Even though when I left at 19, I didn't go far. My apartment on the mainland is a quarter mile from the ferry. Easy access, should Andy ever return. But when I first moved there, Greta acted like I was from a distant, mythical place. "I can't believe you grew up on Blackburn Island," she said. "I'm obsessed with the Blackburn Killer. I have every article that's ever mentioned him, and I spend hours a day on message boards discussing all the theories. Oh my God, did you know any of the victims?" I could recite their names in my sleep. Not just the victims of our island serial killer, who murdered 7 women over 2 decades and was never caught, but the ones from quiet neighborhoods, the ones on city streets. We honored them each year on the anniversaries of their deaths. We uttered their names as we stood in a circle, lighting each other's slim, white candles. Then we whispered the prayer. "We can't restore your life, but we strive to restore your memory with this breath," before blowing out the flames. When I told Greta I didn't know the victims personally, but that they were part of our honoring calendar, her forehead wrinkled with confusion, and I wondered for the first time if Andy had been right, that there was something unnatural about us. But is he here now, sitting on the stairs, watching the door from inside as I force myself to turn its knob and finally push it open? I blink until my eyes adjust. The light outside was dazzling and real, but in here it's dimmer than dusk. The foyer, I see now, is vacant and cavernous. The staircase holds nobody up. The chandelier sways a little, as if something has nudged it, and I have to focus on breathing until the pang of being wrong subsides. "Look who finally showed up. Tate and I have been here since yesterday." I turn toward Charlie's voice. Through the wide archway to the right, I see him sitting in the living room, in curtained, lampless dark. I can just make out the glass of amber liquid in his hand. He sips it now, barely 10 a.m., before he stands and approaches, burgundy sweatered and lanky as ever. "What, you're not a hugger?" he asks with a wink. He embraces me before I can answer. When he lets go, he takes my bag off my shoulder and slings it over his own, the weight of it tipping him farther than his typical sideways slouch. "You look good, dolls," he says. "What's it been, 9 years? I blink at him like he's another dark room I have to get used to. How can he not know it's been 10 years, 4 months, and 3 days since we last saw each other? It's easy to remember. You just take the time it's been since we last saw Andy and subtract 1 day. I suppose, though, that Charlie's tried to see me before now. He's sent me texts over the years, inviting me to his shows, the off-Broadway ones and the really off-Broadway ones, but I've never gone. I knew I wouldn't be able to stomach it, watching him pretend to be somebody else. To me, he'll always be the man who read Andy's note. "The only way out is to never come back," and returned right away to New York. Greta likes to remind me that Charlie was 26 at the time, someone with a life already separate from us. But what she doesn't get is that when I talk about Charlie or Tate or my parents, I'm not looking for perspective. I'm looking for her to agree that all of them failed my twin. Now, I tell Charlie exactly how long it's been, and he eyes me strangely before sipping his drink again. "Where's everyone else?" I ask. "Tate's playing dutiful daughter to the grieving widow upstairs. And Dad, well, he's in the morgue still, waiting for his honoring tomorrow." I skip past the image of our father, cold in a drawer somewhere. "Is that really what we're calling it?" I ask. "An honoring?" Charlie's mouth tilts in amusement. What else would we call it? I shrug. Dad wasn't murdered. It doesn't seem like the honoring rules would apply. Well, he leans in conspiratorially, bourbon on his breath. The way I hear it, Dad's heart was a real bastard about it. Took him out in 2 seconds flat. Pushed him face down in his venison stew. He demonstrates by pitching his head toward the mouth of his glass. Mom had to wipe the meat off his cheeks before the paramedics came. It's poetic, really. Dad hunted so many deer in his lifetime, and in the end, he died on top of one. Seems almost intentional, doesn't it? Like his heart knew what he'd been up to and murdered him for it. He's smirking, and his words are wobbly. Tate's warned me about this. Through her frequent emails, I rarely return. She said that Charlie's a disturbing drunk. That's quite a welcome, I tell him. Thanks. He shrugs like it's no problem. Like it isn't appalling describing our father's death that way. But I don't feel it like the kick in the gut I know I should. I didn't feel much of anything when I learned of Dad's heart attack. Just sort of an, oh, okay. I was at the cafe, looking for traces of Andy in Detroit. I've been working my way through all the major cities again. And Greta overheard me on the phone. She brought me hot chocolate with extra whipped cream and said she was so, so sorry. God, that's awful, Dahlia. But actually, the news of Dad's death was, to me, just news. An inevitable update on the timeline of my life. I get why Charlie's acting out, why he's smirky and buzzed. It's a front, I'm sure, for the pain roiling inside him. Charlie actually knew Dad, in ways that I, and I suspect Tate, never did. Dad paid attention to Charlie the same way he paid attention to Andy. All those shooting lessons over the years, those whispered conversations while scoping the woods for the flick of a tail. I don't know what to do with girls, Dad confessed once, when I asked why it was only boys who got to go on hunting trips. It's not that I wanted to hunt. I just hated the idea of Andy experiencing something without me. But hearing Dad admit that was a relief. I didn't know what to do with him either. This man, with few words and fewer smiles, with no involvement in our education, not even to watch the murder documentaries Mom showed us, with nothing more than nods of acknowledgement whenever he passed me, as if I were an employee, like our groundskeeper, Fritz. I got permission, then, to love Dad less. To not even worry about loving him at all, which was fine with me. It left more space for Andy. Come on, Charlie says. He sets his glass on the credenza, gestures with his chin toward the staircase. Mom's been waiting for you. As I follow him up, I glance behind me, still always checking for Andy. Don't be rude, Dahlia. Say hi to Grandma and Grandpa. Charlie says, throwing me another smirk over his shoulder. And that's fine, if he needs to make this all a joke, but the photos of Mom's parents that line the staircase wall are anything but funny. I know the faces in those frames aren't ghosts. Ghosts don't have weddings, don't smoke cigarettes, don't kiss with smiling lips. But they started this, didn't they? Our haunted childhoods. Our haunted lives. And maybe this is what Andy meant when he said our family was unnatural, because Mom crowded our walls with her murdered parents. It is unusual, our origin story. Mom moved here at 21, to her family's summer house, immediately after home invaders killed her parents at their Connecticut estate. She married Daniel Lighthouse, an orphan himself, who, for someone who didn't know what to do with girls, captivated Mom right away. And Dad indulged her eccentricities, encouraged them even, and did not protest as she turned the mansion into something like a mausoleum. Before we reach the top of the stairs, I hear footsteps on the landing, and then a gasp. It's Tate, pushing Charlie to the side, rushing to meet me. "Dahlia," she says. "What the hell? You're all grown up." She laughs like I'm playing a joke on her, like I'll unzip my skin and emerge as the girl I was the last time she saw me. Then she pulls me into a hug so fierce I almost lose my footing. "Careful, Tate," Charlie says. "Let's not kill our sister, shall we? Mom hardly has any room left in her shrine." He smiles at our grandparents on the wall, as if they're in on the joke. It's weird, though, these hugs they've both given me, as if we lighthouse children were a happy foursome of siblings, not divided into pairs by the difference in our ages, by the fact that Andy and I could read each other's minds, and that Tate just worshipped Charlie. She ignores him now, stepping back to examine me again, and she's as striking as ever, wavy blonde hair piled on top of her head, wayward curls framing her face. She's wearing a turquoise sweater over a pair of magenta jeans, and she's the first bright thing I've seen since entering this house. That's part of her brand now, brightness. When she photographs herself with her dioramas on Instagram, she's always in pink or aqua or yellow. It's contradictory to her depictions of the Blackburn killer's crime scenes, the dark, rocky shores, the obsidian water, those dead women who, even in their miniature ice-blue dresses, look like shadows flung upon the rocks. But it works somehow. I wonder if Andy is one of Tate's 57,000 followers. I wonder if he ever scrolls through the feed of @Di_Orama, feeling exposed by our sister's art. The New York Post profiled her last year, and Greta taped those pages to the cafe wall, insisting I was related to true crime royalty. When I read the article, I held my breath, unsure how much Tate had shared with the Post about our way of life. Greta's the only one I've told about the possibly unnatural things from our childhood, details she's both devoured and savored. The library in the back hall, which we dubbed the victim room, its bookshelves crowded with newspapers reporting on murders. Mom's homeschooling curriculum that required us to write down our own murder reports, in which we presented our theories of unsolved cases in neat 5-paragraph essays. This detail is Greta's favorite. "You were just like me," she says, "a citizen detective." At first, I thought she invented that term, until she told me about the network of people online who lose hours each day investigating cases. The article didn't mention murder reports, but Tate explained that she felt a kinship with the Blackburn killer's victims, given that he'd been active on the island while she lived there. More than that, she believed that by recreating the bodies, right down to the rope marks on the women's necks, the B branded on their ankles, she was returning the focus to the 7 people whose lives were cut short, instead of the intrigue of whatever sick fuck did the cutting. In her Instagram posts, Tate never writes how we grew up honoring those 7 women on the anniversaries of their deaths, accumulating dates as the years went by, as the killer kept strangling, kept branding, kept dressing his victims in identical ice-blue gowns and dumping their bodies in shallow water. But whenever I see Tate's dioramas, those intricate, lifelike, bite-sized crime scenes, I can't help but feel like she's sharing family secrets. "You're so grown up," Tate tells me again. She turns so she appears in profile and tilts her chin up. "And what about me? How do I look? How's..." She pauses to give a mock grimace. 35 treating me." "You look great," I say, but she knows that. In the selfies she posts between dioramas, her followers shower her with praise. Girl, you're gorgeous. I'd kill for your hair. They love her style, her dioramas, her captions about each victim. And they love Blackburn, too. The Post profile, which quoted people who'd learned of Blackburn through @Di_Arama, explained that Tate has essentially transformed it into a tourist destination. That the shores where all those women were found are now a draw, not a deterrent. It's exhilarating, one person said, standing on land where a real serial killer dumped his bodies. It's been a decade since the Blackburn killer last struck, but people on the island still deadbolt their doors, a precaution we never needed. It seemed that no one, not even a serial killer, wanted to slip inside our house. Murder Mansion, the islanders called it. Dahlia, you came. It's Mom at the top of the stairs this time. Of course I came, I say. She's dressed the same as always, sweats and slippers. But she's paler than I've ever seen her, skin like a crumpled piece of paper someone's tried to smooth back out. Mom wraps me in her arms, leaning down to rest her chin on my shoulder. I'm so glad you're here, she says on a sigh. Charlie, above us, fidgets with the strap of my bag. Yes, what a lovely family reunion, he says, right where everyone hoped it would take place, on the stairs. Tate smacks his arm. Mom exhales into my neck, breath heavy with loss. As she hugs me tighter, I feel how potently she's missing Dad. She was like a moth with him, drawn to a light I could never see. When he entered a room, her eyes flew to his face. When he recounted a recent hunting trip, she leaned forward, fluttery with anticipation. He didn't have to say much, usually didn't. And maybe it's because he said so little that she hung on every word, grateful and stunned that he'd spoken to her at all. I'm sorry, I say to her. About what? She asks. Global warming, Charlie can't help but quip. The wage gap? All your fault, dolls. Tate smacks him again. About Dad, I say. Mom pulls back to put her hands on either side of my face. Her eyes are puffy and red, cupped by dark pouches. Don't be sorry about Dad. He didn't suffer at all. It was a quick, natural death. Shocking and horrible, but the best there is in the end. She strokes my cheek. Now if you're going to be sorry about anything... Oh, Mom, not again, Tate says. What? I ask. She's been guilt-tripping us, Charlie says. No, Mom shakes her head. No guilt trip. She's mad, he continues, that we've stayed away for so long. I'm not mad, Mom insists. I've just missed you all, that's all. Tate puts her arm around Mom's shoulder. Do I or do I not call you 3 times a week? She asks. And do I or do I not send you all the treats you can only get in Manhattan? You said you loved those chocolates from Moretti's. I do love those chocolates, Mom agrees. I just love you all more. Ah, that's sweet, Charlie says. But there's something tart in his tone. But like we told you yesterday, which I'm sure Dahlia would agree with, he looks at me meaningfully, urging me to mimic his nod. We've had to make our way, and that requires distance, time. I've been gone as long as I lived here, and I'm still adjusting to the world. Mom swivels to face Charlie, her jaw quivering. I always meant, she says, to prepare you for that, for the outside world. That's what everything was for. She extends her arm toward a photo on the wall, one where her parents laugh at some party, each with a cigarette between their fingers, and she caresses the frame slowly. It's a haunted gesture, as if she's trying to touch the past, trying to save her parents from their future. What Charlie means, Tate says, cutting him a glance, is just, there's so much life out there, you know? I had no idea how much. The world is huge with it. Mom's fingers drop from the frame. Her shoulders slump. And in a way, Tate adds, squeezing Mom closer, I appreciate it more, I think, because of everything you taught us. Don't you agree, Dahlia? Tate's eyes lock onto mine, and they're so blue, so hypnotic, that I find myself nodding. But then I remember Mom's response to Andy's runaway note. Your brother has chosen his own path, and I don't know why I'm bothering to comfort her. She's never cared before if we stayed away, and I still haven't forgiven her for that, for giving Andy up so easily. The fact is, we all had our reasons for never coming back. Charlie claimed he needed to stay close to the city, be ready at the drop of a hat for whatever new role might open up. And because Charlie didn't return to Blackburn, Tate didn't either. Codependent, Greta tisked whenever I told her how they've lived together in the same Manhattan walk-up ever since they both got their inheritance. And me, I lasted only 3 years in the house without Andy, done with dodging the shadows that piled up like dust bunnies in every corner. But what about him? He left without telling me why, without even saying goodbye. And I've had to live all these years in the not knowing, which is a lonely, comfortless place. I know he was troubled by things I wasn't. I know he took his axe to the trees in the woods, not to cut them down, but to wound them, scar them, to make them carry something on their bark he couldn't hold inside anymore. I know his emotions ran hot and hard. He was quick to anger, frustration. But what was it that made him run? I don't believe, I've never believed, that our unnatural life was enough of a reason. I haven't forgiven our family for letting him go. And I haven't forgiven him, either, for going. I'm just glad you're here now, Mom says to us. The circumstances are dreadful, of course, but I'm happy to have all my children back home. All? Did she really just say all? Did you? But I'm cut off by a shout bursting through the back door. Mrs. Lighthouse! Mrs. Lighthouse! The urgency in Fritz's voice prickles the hair on the back of my neck. He limps into the foyer, quick as a man nearing 80 can. His right leg, the bad one, drags a little, and his long, milky hair is streaked with dirt. Mom rushes down the stairs to meet him. What is it? She asks. Charlie, Tate, and I clomp down as well, and when Fritz spots me, he does a double take. You came, he says, breathy from running, from shouting. Of course I came, I say for the second time. What's going on? It's outside, He trails off, prompting Charlie to roll his eyes. What is it? Is everything okay? And I remember this now, how Charlie used to speak to Fritz as if he were dumb. No, Fritz stammers, his focus still on Mom. I was in the woods out back, digging up Mr. Lighthouse's plot, and we're burying him here? Charlie asks Mom. Of course, they'll transport him when we're ready. But isn't that a bit ghoulish? Charlie asks. And it's a strange question, given our lives. Mom's shoulders roll back, as if he's offended her. Not at all. That's where my parents are buried. It's the family plot. We put in stones for your father and me. Guys? Tate says. She gestures to Fritz, whose eyes are wide, seemingly all pupil. I don't know what, our groundskeeper starts, or how, but somebody's already, Already what? Spit it out! Charlie booms, plucking his bourbon off the credenza. Fritz swallows then, throat bobbing in his neck like all those actors in the crime scene reenactments we saw, their fear looking hard and bulbous inside them. It makes me swallow, too. Makes me rub at the hair still rising on the back of my neck. But when Fritz speaks again, his voice doesn't waver. Somebody's already buried in Mr. Lighthouse's plot. And I think... Fritz shifts his gaze to me. I think it's Andy. Two. When was the last time you spoke to your brother? A detective is here. He's sitting across from me in the living room, and he's got a notepad and a pen and a sympathetic smile I don't need. Before this, people in white jumpsuits were shuffling back and forth between a van in the driveway and in the woods in our backyard. They took samples from the bones, or something like that, because it's mostly just bones. It isn't Andy. It's not my brother in that grave, I tell the detective. I hope you're right, he says, and we're working right now to identify the remains, dental records, DNA. But in the meantime, your groundskeeper seemed sure it was Andy. Do you have any idea why that might be? You questioned him, didn't you? I did, but I'd like to hear what you think. I squeeze my mug of hours-old tea. It's the axe. You talked to my siblings, so I'm sure they told you. Andy used to hack at the trees in our backyard. He'd chop them down? No, not chop, more like chip. He'd chip away at them when he was stressed or angry. It was a coping mechanism. He leans forward, repositions his pen. Coping mechanism for what? For, I don't know. He'd get mad sometimes, but I guess, well, Fritz said there was an axe in the... That's what... The body was buried with an axe, he finishes for me, and the skull has fractures consistent with the blade of that axe, leading us to believe, at this point, that the person whose remains are in that grave was killed by the axe they were buried with. And the axe in question appears to belong to your brother. Apparently he carved his name into the handle. Andy had bitten his lip as he engraved it, slicing out the A, the N, struggling with the curve in the D. The skin around his eyes, which crinkled so easily, had crimped with concentration. That's right, I say. But if the murder weapon was Andy's axe, wouldn't the assumption be that Andy was the killer, not the one killed? You think your brother murdered someone? Of course not. I'm just saying, it's not my brother in that grave. My family told you he ran away, right? 10 years ago. Anyone could have used the axe after that, but not on him. He was already gone. So you've spoken to him in the last decade? Yes, I... Well, no, not exactly.
Not exactly?
The curtain behind him sways, a tiny shiver of movement. And even though the living room doors are closed and the windows are locked, I know it's just a draft. I don't think for a moment that it might be Andy's ghost. No, I say. I haven't spoken to him. I've learned that outsiders don't understand the link between Andy and me. I tried explaining it to Greta once, but even she just scrunched up her nose. You mean like telepathy? She asked. And I stopped right there. Didn't bother to describe the time I was lying in bed. Something like 2 a.m., rereading a book on the Black Dahlia. I had a flashlight under the covers, hand over my mouth as I got to the part about the cuts across her face, and I heard my door squeak open. I popped my head out from under the blankets to find Andy, who'd felt my horror in his sleep and had been awakened by it like an alarm. He whispered at me then to put the book away. allow my namesake to rest for once. We knew things about each other, Andy and I, without ever having to utter a word. So if my brother were dead, I would feel it. I would know.
What makes you think he ran away? The detective asks.
I tap my fingernail against the mug. He left a note. My mom told you that already. He nods, flipping back a few pages in his notebook.
The only way out is to never come back, he reads.
What did he mean by that? I tap some more, and he looks at my finger, which instantly stops me.
What did my family say it meant? I ask.
Your sister said to ask you, that you were the closest with Andy.
I am closest with Andy, I correct him, because really, past tense? It's just bones in a hole in the ground and Andy's out there, in Vegas maybe, where people spend thousands each night on the hope for a brighter tomorrow, where any shadows are chased away by flashing, exuberant lights. I bet no one talks murder out there. I bet he loves it.
He wanted something different, I tell the detective, from the way we were raised.
And how were you raised, exactly?
I stare at him. I think you know. With all the commotion before, the people in white jumpsuits, Fritz tracking dirt into the house, throwing condolences around as if he had any way of knowing it was Andy in that grave, I didn't recognize the detective at first. He seemed a few years older than me, and he looked like anybody. Thin, average height, dark hair that swooped at the top, like a cat had been licking him. But when we started this interview, he introduced himself to me again. Elijah Kraft. And I almost laughed. You're Chief Kraft's son, I said. And he had the decency, at least, to look a little sheepish.
He's not the chief anymore, he told me. My father's in a nursing home for dementia. I think I was supposed to feel sorry for him.
But was Edmund Kraft sorry? Did he ever think of it all? His obsession with us back then, his slinking around our property, always with the intention to catch us in some dark criminal act, and feel even a tinge of remorse?
I doubt it.
Chief Kraft was like everyone else, suspicious of us, monitoring us, believing himself entitled to his intrusions.
I know the rumors, Elijah says. Ones your father probably started. I know they call this place Murder Mansion.
They're idiots, I say.
I know your family worships the dead.
And at this, I actually do laugh.
No? Elijah asks, jotting something down. Is that incorrect?
We honor the dead, I tell him, specifically victims of murder. Which Andy isn't. He isn't.
And what does that mean exactly? Elijah asks. To honor them.
I glance at the living room doors, slid together, shut tight. It feels so odd to talk about this with a stranger, especially Chief Kraft's son. I can picture Mom listening at the door, bristling as I speak. But this man is a detective. He's seen bones in our backyard, and I know what he's thinking. On the anniversaries of their murders, I say, we would light candles for them. Say their name, say a prayer. The idea was to meditate on their death, but more important, their life.
A prayer to whom? He asks,
eyes stuck to whatever he's writing.
You said you didn't worship them, but prayer is a means of worship, right?
His pen races across the page, moving too much for the little I've said.
A prayer on their behalf, I reply. To God?
No, not to God. To, I don't know. My siblings and I never took the honorings as seriously as our parents did. Charlie made faces as we lit the candles, shimmied his shoulders as we chanted the words, and the rest of us smothered our smiles so Mom wouldn't see. It was never the murders we were mocking or the victims themselves. We respected every story we learned.
It was just the silly, incessant ritual of it all, as Charlie once said. The idea that candles and a sentence could do anything for the dead. You don't know, Elijah repeats. God wasn't part of our homeschool curriculum. Now he looks at me, his eyes shadowed by dark brows, narrow. I've heard it referred to as the murder curriculum. Is it true that's all you learned about? Murder? We learned about murders, I correct him. And that was your whole education? Just murder? Murders, I say again, because there's a world of difference. We learned plenty of other things, too. I know math up to trigonometry. I know supernovas and black holes. I know the Gettysburg Address. I just also know Rachel Nichol. 49 stab wounds. Killed in broad daylight. Her 2-year-old son covered in her blood. And she is? Elijah prompts. I remember Mom's reenactment. This was something she did to illustrate the brutality of a crime, and to protect us against it. She believed that if we witnessed the horrors that others had experienced, we'd recognize the same danger if it ever came our way. For Rachel Nichols' reenactment, she wore an outfit of all white and jabbed herself with a red marker, scribbling on her shirt to indicate blood. 49 times she struck herself. 49 times I flinched. She was murdered, I say. He bites the inside of his cheek, but it feels like he's biting his tongue. I see. He looks at his notebook again. So you say Andy left 10 years ago, when the two of you were 16. The night of our 16th birthday. Yes. And what was he like that day, the last time you saw him? He was fine, I say. Our siblings had come back for the first time since they'd left home. It'd been 8 years since we'd seen Charlie, 7 since Tate. So he was excited. Excited is not the right word, but I'm certain that the real ones, moody, jittery, would only keep the detective jotting in his notebook. I remember it well, though. The way Andy's leg shook beneath the table like a jackhammer. I remember later, Charlie staring at us from across the candles as we said the prayers for our namesakes. He seemed astonished by us, almost unsettled, like he'd only now remembered we existed. I glanced at Andy to see if he'd noticed our brother's stare, but he was scowling at his candle as if he could blow out its flame with only his gaze. He'd been stormy for days, spending more time with the trees, his axe. Whenever I asked him what was wrong, he snapped away from me like a startled animal. Nothing, I'm just tired. I haven't been sleeping well. And he did have bags beneath his eyes, dark as bruises. On our birthday, he went off to bed soon after the honoring, grumbling about Tate and Charlie, how they scurried away together into one of their rooms before the smoke from the candles had even cleared. He'd been planning to ask them about out, he said. That's what he called it. Out. Excited, Elijah echoes. So excited he ran away that night. So excited he said, the only way out is to never come back. I fidget with my mug. We were very sheltered growing up. We really only left the island a handful of times. And I think Andy saw Charlie and Tate that night, back from a big city, and got inspired to leave early. Be out in the world like them. That's what I've been telling myself for all these years. But inspired or not, Andy broke something that night when he left. I always pictured our connection like a silver cord between us, a taut wire. But when he wrote that note, snuck into the darkness to wait for the ferry, he might as well have cut it in two, hacked it apart with an axe. Inspired to leave early, Elijah mumbles, reading back his notes. Earlier than what? 18, when we were supposed to leave. His expression darkens. You were forced to leave at 18? No, not forced, just... Our siblings did it first, when they each gained control of their trust funds, and Andy and I plan to do the same. The trust fund is how I manage the way I do. Jobless, hunched over my laptop, scouring photos of any crowd on social media, looking for crinkly eyes, for the cowlick on the back of Andy's head. Elijah nods, writing down my answer. "And once someone in your family left home," he says, "they just never returned? Until now, anyway?" He pauses. "I was sorry to hear about your father." But he doesn't sound sorry. He sounds suspicious. His gaze creeps around my head to the wall behind me, where honoring candles are stacked like skinny firewood on the shelves. "Like I said," I tell him, "Charlie and Tate came back one time." "That's right. On the night before you noticed Andy was gone, 10 years ago. Why did they come back on that night in particular?" I shrug. I've never known what was special to them about our 16th birthday. It wasn't the rite of passage to us that it was to others. We weren't gifted cars, like kids in movies. "Was there something specific," he tilts forward, "that all of you were staying away from?" He lowers his voice. "Did your parents ever hurt you?" "What? No." "Then why didn't any of you come back?" "I don't know. I don't know about Charlie and Tate. Other than Tate doesn't do anything without Charlie, and Charlie wanted to stay in New York. But me, my brother ran away, and I waited for him until I was 19, until I finally took him for his word, what he said in the note about never coming back. And I wasn't as close with the rest of my family as I was with him." That's an understatement. The truth is, it felt pointless to get close to them. Mom was always dying in front of us, each reenactment more convincing than the last. So I began to think of her as only half there. Dad was there even less, lacing his boots to head out hunting, barely registering my presence, even as we stood in the same circle for honorings. Charlie and Tate were a unit, indifferent and impenetrable to Andy and me, which was fine, because Andy and I were a unit too. And as long as I had him, I knew I was valued, complete. Andy gave me the best of everything. If we split a sandwich, he handed me the bigger half. If he grabbed 2 glasses from the cabinet, he offered me the one without water spots. If we sat on the porch steps, he gestured for me to take the seat in the sun. I'd say to him, "You deserve the best thing too, you know." And he'd reply, "No, I don't. Not like you." So if he wasn't here, I say to Elijah around the lump in my throat, if he wasn't going to be here, then I didn't see the need to be here either. Elijah scribbles, then turns the page, scribbles again. "And what about your groundskeeper, John Fritz?" he says, eyes on the words he writes even as he speaks. "Did he ever hurt you?" "Fritz?" I spit out. "Why would Fritz ever hurt me? I've known him my whole life." He snaps his head up. "People we've known our whole lives can still hurt us. Some might argue they can hurt us more." "More than what?" He glances at the page. "A stranger." He pulls in his lower lip, chewing it for a moment. Through the doors, I hear someone's footsteps. They get close, get silent, and then they move away. Elijah clears his throat. "It appears a crime's been committed. You understand that, right?" My mind leaps to Andy's namesake. All those Borden crime scene photos. The couch with a back like 3 cresting waves. Andrew's head against the pillow, as if he'd merely been napping. But the blood, the split skull, the implication of an axe. It isn't Andy lying out there. He's in Jacksonville or Lansing or some city I haven't covered yet in my latest round of searches. But he isn't. He has not been here. I understand. I say. But I don't know who was killed out there, and I don't know who killed them either. And you can't possibly think, Fritz? Fritz, who rested his arm on the handle of a rake, watching us laugh in our leaf piles. Fritz, who swept more leaves together, telling us, go ahead, dive in. Fritz, with a pronounced limp from an injury he doesn't talk about. Fritz, who picks up every caterpillar he finds, strokes its back, wishes it good luck in the cocoon. We're going to be investigating all possibilities, Elijah says. Okay, so does that include the Blackburn killer? Because Fritz isn't a murderer. But we've got one, don't we, on this island? One your dad failed to find? Elijah squints at me. We both know it isn't fair to put that on Chief Kraft. The Blackburn killer was masterfully elusive, his kills sporadic enough to seem almost random. 2 years went by between the first two murders, 4 between the final two, and the month always varied. The first woman was killed in September, and the last, 19 years later, in July. The police never found his DNA, either. When he dragged the bodies into shallow water, he made sure of that. By the time they washed back onto shore, a different stretch of shore each time, the salty ocean had licked them clean. And another thing, the nails of the women were always immaculate. Not a single foreign cell stuck beneath them. In one of Greta's breathless monologues about the Blackburn killer, she told me how the police focused on the blue dresses for a while, tried to find who designed them, where they'd been purchased. But that was a dead end, too, as if the gowns, gauzy and cold, had been stitched from the ocean itself. Even the branding iron, with which the Blackburn killer marked the women's ankles, led police nowhere. Experts said the curve of the B was crude and rudimentary, Greta explained. So they think it was made by the killer himself. Surely you know, Elijah says, that the death in question is nothing like the deaths of those women. They were discovered on the shore, for one thing. This person was buried, he pauses, on your property. I tighten my grip on the mug. But as I said, he continues, we'll be investigating all possibilities. On the table beside him, his phone rings. He frowns at its screen. Excuse me, I need to take this. As he slides apart the living room doors, the darkness of the foyer gapes like the mouth of a cave. Strange that nobody's turned on the chandelier, that the 8 p.m. sky seems brighter than the inside of our house. Elijah steps outside to answer his phone, and I feel my way along the walls, following the voices coming from the kitchen. The swinging door is closed, but when I open it, there's finally light. A little, at least, from the bulb above the stove. Tate and Charlie sit at the counter, legs dangling from stools, palms circling mugs. Mom paces back and forth between the sink and the oven. Is Detective Good Boy done with you? Charlie slurs. And I don't think it's tea in his mug. He got a call. From the Bone People? Tate asks, her spine straightening. Is that what we're calling them? Charlie says. I'm fine with it if we are. Did you see that one guy, the really tall one? He can bone me whenever he wants. Charles, Mom says, voice like a whip. Sorry, Mom, sorry. Not my fault. It's the city. It's made me so crass. It's made you an ass, Tate mumbles, and Charlie slaps his hand over his heart, pretending to reel from a stab. Stop, Tate whines. She puts her elbows on the counter, massaging her temples. You're acting like we're hanging out at a bar or something when really... Oh, Charlie cuts her off, looking around as if taking in his surroundings for the first time. This isn't a bar? No wonder the service sucks. When really, Tate continues, We're waiting to hear if it was our brother out there. It wasn't Andy, I say. Charlie turns so sharply I almost jump.
Is that what Kraft said? He asks.
No, I just know. He's not dead. Mom makes it over to me in two quick strides. You've spoken to him, haven't you? Your brother? She picks up my hand, stroking the back of it with a firm, insistent touch. In these last 10 years, you've heard from him, right? And maybe you didn't tell me because he needed more time away, but you know where he is, don't you? Her eyes are frantic, flicking like a too-fast metronome. I start to say, but the kitchen door swings open behind me, and I look back to find Elijah Kraft. In one hand, he holds his cell phone, and in the other, dangling at his side, is the notepad where he's been writing down our lives. Mom's grip on my hand tightens. Tate and Charlie perk up on their stools. Is there news? Tate asks, just as Mom says, what is it? Elijah glances at his feet, and when he looks up, he looks around. At the clock that's always broken. At the honoring calendar pinned to the wall. At the butcher block and all its knives.
I'm afraid, he begins,
and right away, it's like someone turns down the volume,
that we've been able to confirm it.
And this, as he continues, comes to me as only a whisper.
The remains in the grave,
they belong to.
And this,
like a blade thrusting toward me, comes to me in silence, but I'd known the shape of his name anywhere. I can see it on Elijah's lips.
Andy.
Mom screams. I see her mouth split open, her face go red. But I don't hear it. I don't hear anything at all.